terms of the library at Toronto, was there, in terms of the book selection of the library at Toronto, was there much evidence that there was, the foreign policy goals were paramount when books were chosen, or?
We got a monthly list of recommended program books. And I think what we did, I certainly sat there and put check marks in the margin. I certainly picked the books I wanted. But I think I was aware that it was wise every once in a while to throw in a foreign policy book, so I did. And I think the librarian did too, and I think we chose basically out of that list, which was already pre-selected, you understand, the books that seemed to us to be the most useful, and we threw in a few sops to agency line. The U.S. foreign policy line in Iran was as interesting to them as if we told them that we were interested in the relations between Niger and Chad. It didn't make any sense to them. They couldn't have cared less. All they cared is, were we on their side? Would we support them if the Russians moved in on them? That's about the end of it.
Okay. Now, at our first meeting, you discussed the activities of the Iran American Society and the student center that Iran, and you mentioned the society in passing from time to time since then. Now, what was the relationship between USIA and society? What was the organizational relationship between the two entities?
Well, again, I have to hesitate to answer that because the relationship changed over time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it changed as the organization grew. Let me start by just giving you a history of the building. Maybe that'll give you the idea. When we started off, the Iran American Society was a room. This was in the 50s. A room somewhere where a club of friends came to meet. Then, in 1961 or 2 or 3, the society convinced the Iranian government to give them a large piece of land, not in the north part of the city, but in the part of the city which was on the frontier leading north. An enormously desirable piece of land, which became more desirable by the year. It was a large piece of land, and a building was put up on that building, on that site, in 1964, designed by some architects in Rome. A very beautiful building, in fact. When I got there in 66, the Iran American Society consisted of three separate installations. There was that building, which had a theater in it, art gallery, a small library, a restaurant, a few things like that. There was a second installation, which was a large, sort of a converted apartment house building downtown, right near the university, which taught English to a lot of students every day, 4,000. And across the street from the university, for reasons best known to history, there was a thing called the Student Center. We ran the only student center for the whole University of Tehran. It was run by an extraordinarily interesting woman from Mashhad named Ziai, who's one of those who stayed after the revolution and made her peace with the new forces in Iran, and still there, as far as I know, Mohadari Ziai. And she ran a very peculiar student center, which had very little to do with the United States, except that she called it a U.S. Thing. So it was part of, the empire had three parts. Now, the director at that time, then when Lois Roth went up there, when Jay Gilner was the PAO, it was decided to build an enormous addition to the building. And that building was to house the USIS library, which would move up there, and the English teaching division. And we would consolidate, in other words, the things in one place. The decision had not yet been made to close the student center. No one was even talking about it, but the student center was, the closing of it was announced in the spring of 72, I think was closed out in the summer of 72. So that's that building was finished sometime after Lois Roth left. She never, she didn't see it open. She was there for the building of 90% of it. But it was never open. It was not a program facility until after she left. And then came others, and I'm really not quite privy to the story after that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did it relate to the USIS? Very simply, the director was a USIS officer. The deputy director was a USIS officer. Up until 1967, there was an additional program director, who was a USIS officer. I'm talking now about people on full salary, with perks and all the rest. It was a heavy investment. The director of courses at the English Teaching Center and the deputy director of courses were also USIS contract employees. Now, we had five full-time people living there in Tehran running that center. Now, what that meant, let's assume that in those days that meant a total investment of $250,000. Let's see. Now, the idea was that you made money on English teaching. We sold our English teaching, we charged for it. We carefully calibrated our costs, our fees, to undercut the British Council. We charged less than anybody in town. We had the cheapest game in town. It wasn't always the best game in town, but in terms of quality, but it was good enough. And sometimes, and in a way, because our approach was oral rather than through the written word, it was probably more relevant to their needs. We thought it was a good enough game, and we consistently tried to make it better. After all, two salaries of professional English language teaching people isn't so bad. And we were designing our own materials and printing our own press books, which we printed and sold, by the way, and made money on those as well. In other words, there was a lot of revenue being generated by the English teaching unit. That revenue paid for the programs in the main Iran American Society. In other words, the whole Iran American Society had a budget in Lois Roth's time somewhere in the range of $750,000. And if you count the five salaries, which were reduced to four by then, you're talking about another close to $1 million somehow or other was moving around in that thing. Mm-hmm. And the result of the whole thing was an operation which essentially paid for itself, except for those salaries. So that's how it related. Now the real relationship question is what kind of control did USIS have over it? And that, of course, depended on the director. The director, when I got there, couldn't care less what USIA wanted or USIS wanted in the center. Occasionally he would do something they insisted on, but for the most part, he just did his own thing. Mm-hmm. If we had a moon rock come to Tehran, we put on an exhibit of the moon rock. Of course we did. Wouldn't you? If we had space films, you put on space films. But if you had films about Vietnam, he would politely refuse to use them. Now, after him came a very, very creative, wild man who made the center into much more of a functioning, creative, artistic kind of a place, and was even less interested in programming what USIA did. Followed by Lois Roth, who consolidated that creativity and built this other dimension. And
what before Roth?
A guy named Dean Anderson, who's living in New York now, retired. A very gifted guy, an actor, basically. And Lois's game was to do a lot of things. I could really get you a piece of paper and read them to you, in a sense. But they were, first of all, to pay for this new building. That was important. She had to find the money to pay off the loan. Second, to make the building legal. For years, it had functioned in an extraterritorial way. The employees were not registered with the social security system and so forth and so on. She tried to legalize all that. And for example, taxes had never been paid on certain things. She went into the taxes and went literally into the back taxes and got an enormous bill from the taxes when the final reckoning was down. And I remember a very, very critical conversation with the mayor of Tehran, in which he told her that they had applied for exemption from this back tax because it would have been crippling, an enormous amount, $1 million or something like that. And I remember a dinner at which she sat next to the mayor, and he leaned over and said to her, "Ms. Roth, I'm sorry to tell you the decision is going against you. You're going to have to pay those taxes. But when you've paid them, I'll make a grant to you from the city of Tehran for the same amount." That's the way things were done in Iran in those days. But it suited Lois's purpose because she wanted to make the place legal. Now, the next thing, she wanted to make it an indigenous Iranian institution at the center of the intellectual and artistic life of Iran, which she sure as heck did. And fourth, I think she wanted to keep her master's in USIS and in USIA happy by being, by using the materials they gave her in ways that were creative enough and that fit into the context that she was trying to establish. So she developed a lot of skills at taking the package, never on Vietnam, by the way. Nobody ever pushed that. Nobody even tried by the time Lois was there. You didn't even think about that. But on foreign policy questions, well, we would have ways of putting people on the platform with them and so forth that were intriguing, interesting, and so forth. And all things considered, I would say that in the 2 years that Lois Roth was there, 3 years, whatever it was, she controlled that program about 99.5%. The problem is, in the last year, it's perfectly obvious from her correspondence that there was a lot of resentment. There was resentment because she was in many ways more visible, more powerful than the PAO, and in some ways more visible and powerful than the ambassador. She knew everybody in Iran, and there was obviously the resentment of the mediocre about that thing. There was also the persistent strain that the Iran-American Society was a funhouse, a pleasure palace that had no relevance to the USIA program as it was defined in Washington, which, as I've explained to you, was really had very little relevance to Iran. We were always shaping that in local terms anyway. But in the spring of 71, no, sorry, in the, either in the fall of 71 or the spring of 72, a big Rome inspection took place. Inspection of Tehran. What happens is that periodically a group of USIA officers are pulled together to go and live in a post for a month or so, and then they write a long report about it. Mm-hmm. And in that report, the Iran America Society comes out as the only thing that's happening. This post is incredible, only because of the Iran America Society. Mm-hmm. By then it was the biggest, most successful bi-national center in the world. Lois Roth's big problem that last year was that everybody would come from Germany, from Thailand, from everywhere to visit this thing. And she had to spend a lot of time telling how it worked. Okay. This took up a lot of her time. But the real problem in her last year, as I read the documents, is that the program that she and I had worked on for 3 years, which was conceptually related, interrelated, and was in many ways a sort of an organic thing having to do with the interface between Iranian society and American society at that time, and husbanding certain elements that were useful in the United States for the proper movement of Iran, the direct movement in socioeconomic and political terms, all fell apart because the cultural officer who succeeded me was on his last post, was tired, didn't much care, and had a remarkable incapacity for remembering anybody's name. By then he'd fallen into a very peculiar habit of smiling and mouthing cliches so that no one could ever remember his name. It was really a very, very sad business. And for Lois, who had worked in that office, to see that office fall apart. But what that really meant was that the intellectual core of the program had really come out of the cultural office. And so that takes us back now to the fundamental question, not only in the program, but in a very simple question, is how did the Iran-America Society director relate to the USIS operation? And that was a long and complicated problem. There had been a very powerful cultural attaché just before me, a little bit before me, who had insisted that the Iran-America Society director was one of his deputies. In fact, he had insisted that the Iran-America Society's car and driver were his, not the Iran-America Society's. By the time I got there, the director had achieved more or less equal status with the cultural attaché, and we were colleagues and brothers. And that stayed that way. Until Lois went up there. Now Lois Roth went up there from being my deputy to running that office. Now, on administrative terms, I wanted her not only to be co-equal with me, but in totally autonomous up there. And that's the way we ran it. But she was still intellectually part of my program and recognized it, accepted it, and wanted it. But and in administrative terms, she was the boss up there. There wasn't any question. There was total autonomy. Now, when a PAO then came in the year I left, he didn't understand that at all. And he wrote her memos through the cultural attaché and expected her to communicate with him through the cultural attaché. Well, if the cultural attaché had been up to it, that might have been one thing. But since he was slightly out to lunch, it didn't work that way. And the result was that she finally had to sit down with him and said, look, this is not the way it's been. This is not the way it ought to be. And it's not the way it's going to work. And to his credit, the man in charge immediately saw that that was true and revised that that arrangement and began treating her like the autonomous person she was. But I assure you that when she left, the ambassador did not have the visibility that she had. She didn't have the access to the upper levels, but she knew half the members of the cabinet by their first names if she wanted to. The Queen more than once saw her, called her aside at events, and said to her, you must understand that in my position I can't come to the Iran-American Society, but never think I don't know what's going on there and what you're trying to do. And in fact, the Queen, after Lois Roth left, the Queen asked the International Executive Service Corps, which you know what that is? It's for retired people to come back, to come to situations like that, retired businessmen, for example. The Queen asked the IESC to get Lois to come back to help run Iran's cultural development and to build a cultural center in Tehran that would embody the same kinds of things that she'd proved could be done in the Iran-America Society. And the interesting thing was that that request was delivered to the public affairs officer and never turned over to anybody. He just put it in a drawer. And she found out about it from somebody else and really went into a dudgeon. Not that she would have taken it, but she at least wanted the right to, the honor of being asked and the right to refuse in her way. Which, by the way, reminds me to tell you one thing that I have not seen in Jim Bill's book yet. I haven't finished it, but I don't think he gives any recognition so far in what I've said, and it's we're into the late 60s, of the role the Queen was playing. The Queen was not a Pahlavi, after all. She married a Pahlavi, and she was an enormous, enormous tempering force in all of that. In many ways, the Queen was the way out of the Pahlavi dilemma. If it had worked out that way. She was an extraordinary person. She is an extraordinary person and played an enormous role when she was allowed to. In all the space she was allowed to occupy, she really did a job.
Andrea, I remember you mentioned you had some contact with Iranian writers, artists, intellectuals. Who were some of the major contacts that you developed in the intellectual and artistic community of Iran, I guess, or Iran generally?
My contacts in Iran began with the university world. There wasn't a university chancellor, rector, president, very few deans that I didn't know. And see, the symbol of our presence at that time was that the American-trained Iranians were coming back and were being integrated into society. And we were part of that process. And I knew them up and down. I mean, I have an extraordinary memory for people's names, faces, trivial data about them and so forth that is probably my principal stock in trade. I'm not terribly proud of it, but it's very useful in getting along with large numbers of people. So I don't think there was a university in that country where I couldn't really walk in unannounced and say hi to the chancellor if I wanted to. I would never have done anything like that. Now, the second group of people that I knew pretty well were those involved in developmental thinking. Plan organization people, central bank people, ministries of development like labor, social affairs, and so forth. These were areas that I knew a great deal about. Another area I happened to know a great deal about was medicine, of all things, medical education. Legal education. So you see, most of this focuses on universities and then outward. Remember that in the Iranian universities, like the French universities, In the professional schools, they are not full-time faculty. They are doctors who also teach, not teachers who also doctor. And the result was that if you knew a university professor of medicine, you knew also a very important practicing physician. So there was that that element. Where do you go from there?
What, I mean, like writers, artists?
Well, you know, such artists as there were, such artists as there were, I knew them all. I mean, I didn't really, I didn't think of them as important. I left that really to Lois because all things considered, they were friends. God knows they would invite me to their parties and all that. But I was interested in, I was not so much interested in their personal development as artists. That was happening. I was interested in the context in which, I was more interested in finding markets for their paintings is what I was finding out. Ways to get them independent of the system. So the sculptor Parviz Tanavali was only one of many, 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 many people. There was a writer named Golestan who was a drunk and a very, very interesting man, a filmmaker and so forth. But, he and I sat down and we tried to translate one of his stories, which I never finished. So I still have the notes for him in my drawer. And it was just sooner or later that if they spoke French or English, I knew them all. If they didn't speak French or English, I may have met them, probably met them in most cases. But I couldn't particularly. Jalal al-Ahmad was the one I probably knew best. In fact, he died, and while I was there, and I was the only foreigner at his funeral at the mosque, and there was a painter named Hannibal al-Khas, I think his name was, and he did a painting. He did a painting, a 40-foot long canvas on a single piece of canvas. Which we put on at one of the, in the workshop at the Iran America Society. He had a special memorial service for Jalal al-Ahmad. So these people, I mean, I was working, for example, when we picked Tahrir Safarzadeh to go to the Iowa workshop, that meant going around and asking all the writers in town, who was the right person to go on this thing? So basically, I was interested in getting those writers broadened out, broader experiences, this and that and the other thing, but I didn't sit with them and worry about the anguish of their art particularly much. To some extent, Lois did that. We were simply, I just knew them, that's all. I mean, if I wanted to walk in and talk to any of those people, I knew how to do it. If I didn't know the person, I could call up Bill Royce and say, I want to meet so-and-so. And Bill would say, okay, we'll get that organized. You see, it was that society in which the access was such, the elite was small enough that you could really be in touch with virtually all of them. Virtually all of them.
You said you knew Jalal Ahmad. Do you know much about his influence on cultural criticism?
Oh, yeah. Westernization? Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I have letters from him that probably ought to be published. Not letters, I have one letter from him, which really needles the hell out of us. In fact, it was the first thing he ever wrote me. And it was a nasty letter, and I spent the rest of the time there sort of teasing him about that nasty letter. It was all about Westernization, West toxification, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
And there was another man named Shadman who had written a book, forget his name. He died while I was there too, but he had also brought up this whole idea of West toxification. But there were the intellectuals, for example, the intellectuals that were grouped around the Ministry of Higher Education and Scientific Research. They were all really passionately involved in this question of what is really the meaning of Westernization and modernization. What are the hooks in that idea? We're not so sure we want to westernize if it means becoming like you. Mm-hmm. And I was saying to them, sure, you're damn right. Please do not imitate us. But you ought to be able to pick some of the things that we've done well and to avoid some of the horrible mistakes we've made. And that's what I was projecting, that side of America that was relevant to them.
Mm-hmm.
One key person, I think, that I got close to was Hossein Nasr, who's now here as university professor at UW. Although he was a very ambivalent man, he was preaching Shia Islam superiority to Christianity, to anything you want. A rather peculiar man, an enormous, towering intellectual, but with an agenda, political religious agenda that was very bizarre, I thought, at the time. But he and I were constantly in little bits and ends of dialogues. Lois, when I left, Lois was a far better listener than I was. I talked too much. And I was dealing with, I would go to a cocktail party and there would be 20 people to talk to. So you have a little 3-minute conversation with this one and that one. And since I was able to remember what we talked about last time, yeah, I could usually pick up where we left off. But Lois had much longer and thorough talks with Master the year that I was away, and she was still there, and I remember her writing letters about them, and I was thinking that she'd gotten closer to him than I had ever been able to. But in any case, the nature of my life was inherently superficial because I knew too many people and had too many things to do with them, but I was in touch with everybody.
Now, in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a lecture hall at Husseini Arshad in Tehran, which was a place where leading scholars and religious figures lectured on the topic of the day. Did you know much about this lecture hall at the time that you were stationed in Tehran?
In the spring of 1971, I did a long set of conversations with an Iranian psychiatrist named Saab Zamani. Forget his name, Abol something. Sahab Zamani, the hyphen. And he was an Iranian trained person interested in mental health. Not very many of those. Never studied abroad. But he had been sent before I came, in fact, the year I came, I guess he was just back, on an Eisenhower grad, and spent the better part of the year in the United States poking around. And he was an uncomfortable man. His English wasn't very good, and he didn't speak any French. But I used to see him all the time, and I found he was a little bit unusual. So we developed a very peculiar format of long lunches and dialogues in which we would just talk about probably the most profound and consequent conversations I ever had then. Mm-hmm. And he was the first one that pointed out the complexities of the religious case here. He was one, for example, who reminded me of the ambivalence of Nasser's role. Nasser, who was trying to be an authority in the religious community in Iran, but had not studied at Gaon, had studied at Harvard. And the mullahs, of course, didn't accept anybody who hadn't studied at Gaon. And so he kept saying, you know, Nasser is a brilliant man, but he's not reaching these people. They're not interested in him. They don't give him any money. In the course of these conversations, he first mentioned the Husseini Shah. I had seen it being built on over there on whatever that street was, Eisenhower, I think it was called. Whatever that big boulevard was going north, there were two axes going north, and it was the one further to the east. I think it was called Eisenhower, as a matter of fact, which is odd and probably ironic. But there was this rather ugly building which had been put up, and it was looked like a great big barn, really, an enormous brick wall. And he said, you know, we've really got to go to, let's go together to that one night. He said, it is phenomenal. He said, you won't believe it. There are people up there, and they get up there and they talk, and the audience is incredible. They sit on the edges of their chairs. It's people who are intellectuals, who are students, who are taxi drivers, it's everybody, it's all mixed up. Something's really going on over there. Let's go. Well, I never got organized to go. And the person speaking, of course, was Ali Shariati.
Did he tell you about him?
Hmm?
Did he tell you about him?
You know, the name doesn't really strike a bell, in fairness,
in that context. Yeah.
In that context. Yeah. But he told me about what was happening there, and he did say there was one particular fellow who was standing up among the other ones. And I really, that's my deepest regret, not to have followed that invitation, and to follow it up because, you see, Shariati was a French intellectual, and I could have talked to him. He and I could have related very, very well. But it was the end, it was the spring of 71, I was getting ready to go, it looked like a lot of work. It was those things you had to go and sit there for 2, 3, 4 hours, not understanding really what was going on. And, you know, it's hard.
It was closed not much later, I think, too.
Well,
it was shut down.
It was shut down, but I was gone, so I don't remember when it was shut down, you see. Yeah. But I was there when it was still alive, and when Shariati was... And it's my biggest regret that I didn't pick that up, and that I didn't meet Shariati, and that I didn't say, let's go off and walk in the woods together.
It's hard. It's probably hard to generalize about. It's probably hard to respond to this question. But what kind of attitudes sort of shot did you pick up from your discussions with administrators, intellectuals, writers that you encountered during your?
You mean the Iranian attitudes?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
In the intellectual class. Well, that's a hard question because, again, you know, if I did a statistical survey and asked the right questions, I could give you numbers, but
yeah.
I'd have to say it was very mixed.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, there was a class difference. I mean, after all, his father had been a stable boy for the Cossacks. He came from nowhere. He was not a member of the upper class.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, he was pretending to be. And that bothered them no end. So there was a class distinction. We'll rule that off. That's just snobbery.
Yeah.
Forget about that. There were then really two kinds of intellectuals, as I saw them. There were the kind epitomized by a man named Mohammed Bahiri, who was the deputy minister of court most of the time, and with whom we used to go mountain climbing, walking in the hills north of Tehran every Friday morning. Not every Friday, but frequently on a Friday night. Who had a vague experience with France, but was really 100% Iranian oriented, and who was very typical of the very slowly modernizing sector in a society which, after all, was in the whatever century you want, the 12th or the 14th or the 16th, who cares, 17th, whatever, but way back. And he was an example of that modernizer who felt that Iran had to move carefully forward on its Islamic base towards something else. And there were even American-trained people who fell into that category. The dean, for example, of the School of Public Administration, of all things, felt that we mustn't go too fast. Mustn't go too fast. That was the big danger. And those people tended to say, the Shah has weaknesses and the Shah has strengths. But we're damn lucky to have him. Whatever it is, he's our man. We've got to support him. They supported him relatively uncritically, but were perfectly capable in an unguarded moment of saying this is impossible or this is very difficult. They supported him publicly, they would never criticize him. Privately, under the right circumstances, some of them could be led to say, to admit that they were not entirely sure about his capacity to pull it off. Now, the bright, young, bushy-tailed returnees from overseas were another category. They had a kind of, the fact that they were back was already a commitment. So they were committed. But they were very overtly critical. Overtly is not exactly, again, discreetly but very freely critical. And many, much of the context of my conversation with people like that was what's wrong. But it was what's wrong in a constructive way. What's wrong? How can we solve this problem? How can we solve that problem? Once you take the developmental stance, you see, you take a critical stance. And these people were in that developmental framework. This isn't working. There are reasons why it isn't working. How can we make it work? How can we get around it? Example, a young modernizer who lives here now in the town, well, you've read his book, Ahami, who wrote a book called Anatos, The Death Wish in American Society, in Iranian society, responded to a challenge the year after I left. The Shah said, you and your friends are always giving me a lot of crap about free elections, all right? You are hereby appointed Deputy Minister of the Interior with your friend there, and the two of you are going to run the next election. And you go ahead and make it free. Go ahead. Up to you. Do anything you want. You've got full power. And that election, the election of 80, not 80, of 71, falls, I don't know what it was. Anyway, he'll tell you if you ask him. Afkhani, extraordinary man. And with him was a man, Amin Ali Ma'abi, who's down in Richmond. Ran the freest election ever been run in history of Iran since maybe the 40s. Maybe the 40s, I'm not sure. So you had that kind of intellectual criticism, which the Shah sometimes handled very well. In that particular case, he said, put up or shut up. You've got the power, I give you the power, do it. But they all knew that the Shah had the power of life and death on them. And some of these people, for example, there was one that I'm thinking of now, who said, who was very much favored by the Shah, and the Shah wanted him very much to stay, and he decided he wanted to go to, I don't know, Paris, I think, to work for UNESCO. I think that was the time. He felt he had to go and tell the Shah. And he went to the Shah and said, I'm going to go to Paris to take this UNESCO job with your permission. And the Shah said, oh, we can't spare you and so forth. Please stay. And then he told me the story. Now, this the fact that the Shah said that name is one thing, but the fact that he then told me the story. This is a French intellectual who knew no English, had never had an American friend in his life, was accused by some of being a member of SAVAK. It was a very powerful figure in the social sciences. He said to me, you know what he said to try to lure me to stay? He said, what would you like? Would you like a house on the Caspian? Would you like a Mercedes? Tried to buy them off with creature comforts. Now, his scorn for that was so, the man doesn't understand why I have to get out of this country once in a while. Why it's valuable for Iran that I should be in Paris. Well, that was a constant pattern. So you got that kind of very ambivalent, we support the Shah, but God, I wish you were a better man. And there it boiled down very often to a question of pacing. And there were the impatient ones who said he's not going fast enough. If you really want to make it simple. And the other ones who said he's going too fast, he's got to slow down. Or he's right, he's choosing the right pace, not too fast. Obviously the latter were right in one sense. Now the other thing that I have to say is that they were very aware, while they were terrified of his strength, they were very aware of his weaknesses. They knew that he was very much in the hands of his advisors. He had to be. Can't know everything. Can't be everywhere. So he had to listen to his advisors. They knew that he was under the paw of his father, who had been a giant man. He was a short man. And so on. They just knew a lot of things. They knew that he was intellectually, his growth had been stunted. Remember that he went to a Swiss secondary school. But then he stopped. His intellectual growth had stopped. Surely he hadn't read a book. How could a Shah read a book for that sense? There's no time. If he had read a book, he hadn't read five books in 20 years. Because there just isn't time for that. And so they felt that he was simply inadequate for the job he cut out for himself. But they knew that he meant well, and that he was a lot better than Abdel Nasser or Karim Qasim or people like that. They were damn lucky to have him, and they were willing to put up with the ifs, ands, and buts.
Did you encounter anybody who was opposed to the Shah as such, who wanted a constitutional type system?
Sure.
Who wanted to be, overthrow the Shah?
Overthrow is a different question.
Yeah.
I never encountered anybody that wanted to overthrow the Shah.
Yeah.
Never. That doesn't mean they weren't there.
Yeah.
They just didn't come up to tell me, and I can see why. But I can tell you that the constant burden of the reformers, those who wanted a different system, was to revise the Constitution and go back to relying on a constitutional form of government. Now remember that by the time I got there, the Majlis was a waste of time. It was a hollow instrument. The elections were rigged, the Majlis was rigged, therefore it was a useless thing. The question of whether it could have been changed over time with what agitated. Can we get a better Majlis? If we get a better Majlis, can we revise the Constitution? Can the Shah be persuaded to let loose a little of that power? Can the Shah be persuaded to delegate power to the next level down, or even partly to the Majlis? Can all that be done? So the question of the political development of Iran was very much on everybody's mind.
Mm-hmm.
But it was in a constructive vein, as far as I saw. Now, I think there were a couple of episodes. There was an episode of a place called Siyakal in the fall of 70, where some kids were up in the north, up there on the Caspian in the woods, were literally setting up, there were, you know, bombs and stuff like that. Yeah. And they went in and cleaned them out. It was a mess. It was terrible. But that was the first time that you had a sense. Explosives began coming in, and then in that last year, probably from East Germany, we were told. But, you know, there were groups, you know, which were interested in violence. There's no question about it. I mean, after all, there was a kidnapping attempt on Douglas MacArthur. There were bombs, as I said, 7 bombs in the last year and a half that I was there, year after I left. There were a lot of things, bad signs, particularly that last year that I was there, you see. I've always said that my 5 years in Iran were 4 years of tremendous buoyant optimism and 1 year of disillusionment. Mm-hmm. And Lois's was even more so. Mm-hmm. So that you really, you get the sense that in 1970 you passed a peak of this or that. So the intellectuals' attitudes towards him were very ethical. They wanted him to be better. They wished he was better. But, and they had a great deal of difficulty tolerating the kind of one-man rule that he was responsible for.
Did you, while you were in Iran, did you do any reporting on this kind of, on these trends of thought, kinds of thinking that went to the embassy or back to the State Department?
I've always believed that a cultural officer should not report, yeah, per se. I must have told you this, that we're not trained for diplomatic reporting and that we shouldn't be asked to do it. So I've always struck a bargain with the political section that I would be willing to talk to any of them, or all of them, periodically. So I never wrote anything. If you read my planning documents, my reporting documents, it was shot through with comments on the system. You have to find them. I've not kept them. I wasn't able to keep them. There are hundreds of them, but you would find it was shot through with awareness of where there were weaknesses and the ability of our systems and our programs to try to build strength in these areas. But I did no political reporting. However, every Friday, I think it was at 3 o'clock, one of the younger people from the political section would come over and we'd have a bull session.
I think you mentioned that one.
For an hour or two, every week, religiously. Mm-hmm. And that, as far as I was concerned, was enough reporting for me.
Mm-hmm. With the election of Nixon in 68, there were new policymakers at the State Department and USIA. Now, how much of a change in cultural diplomacy goals or programs was there under the regime of William Rogers and Frank Shakespeare?
You know, a program gets wound up and committed years in advance, and things are rolling and things are successful, and most of them are not cutting edge things anyway. They're part of a broader contextual sort of thing. And I would have to say that change to Shakespeare at our level didn't mean a damn thing. Not a thing. But the things that changed were the change of ambassador from Armin Meyer to Douglas MacArthur, and that I've talked about. The other thing was that Shakespeare came out once, and we had a long lunch, and Shakespeare was talking about how we had a big fight at the table. I mean, a polite fight, because I'd said something about the Greek colonels as not being maybe the best answer for Greece. And